Welcome to Inspiring People and Places, where we interview national leaders in the architectural, engineering, construction, and development industry in an effort to educate, innovate, and inspire industry professionals to disrupt the status quo, improve their project teams, and steward public and private investments more effectively. I'm your host, BJ Kramer, President and CEO of MCFA. Allow me to introduce today's guest. All right, inspiring people and places. We talk all the time that in order to inspire people or inspire places, it starts with leadership. The built environment all around us has engineers, it has financial professionals, it has project managers. But at the end of the day, bringing a team together to accomplish a task comes down to leadership. Today's guest, we just spent 30 minutes pre-call just shooting the breeze about leadership, and he's probably touched every level of content and curriculum development, content and curriculum delivery, and as well as consulting around building leadership teams and high functioning teams. And he found it all out through his lessons learned in the Navy SEAL. Welcome to the show, Larry Yatch.
It's awesome to be here.
Awesome to have you. All right. I know a little bit of your background because I've seen you speak, I've read your book, but for those who don't know you, give us kind of the top of the waves on Larry Yatch's story. Why don't we go from maybe pre-Naval Academy to present day?
Yeah, the start for me was with Tom Cruise. I saw Top Gun in third grade. And by the time I left the movie theater, I was 100% convinced I was going to be a fighter pilot. And then my dad showed me The Right Stuff, that movie with all the astronauts. And the coolest ones were in the Navy. And so it was like Naval Academy, go be a fighter pilot by literally third grade. And then I'm a bit on the autistic spectrum with a little bit of Asperger's. And so when I get focused on something, like, that's it. So from third grade, that was it. Like, I never wavered off of this path until seventh or eighth grade. A friend of mine for my birthday got me a sweatshirt that said Navy SEALs on it. At that time, this would have been late 80s, early 90s. No one knew what a Navy SEAL, including me, was. Like, he just got it because it said Navy and had a cool logo. So I went to the library, found a book called The Men with Green Faces, which was a Vietnam era SEAL book. And by the end of the book, fighter pilots are pansies. I need to be a Navy SEAL. only problem is I'm like 6'3", 200 plus pounds now, but in high school, I was 5'2", 107 pounds and a nerd. I like grew up in the city in Pittsburgh. If it had a ball or a team, I was useless at it. And I was on this goal of going to the Naval Academy. So I would have definitely been voted least likely to be a Navy SEAL out of high school. Got into the Naval Academy in 1994, graduated in 98, and competed and got a chance to go into SEAL training right out of the Naval Academy. I graduated my class 222, went straight through, graduated at the top of my class. And our class was very small. It was one of the last winter classes where we started in late September and ended in early April. So it's just the worst time to go through buds. We had such a small class that I got to pick whatever team I wanted to go to. And I chose SEAL Team 3 because Team 3 was responsible for the Middle East. And in what would have been spring of 99, there was nothing going on. And I figured if there was, it was going to show up in the Middle East. And as we know from history, I was accurate. So I'll pause there. At least that's the early part.
Yeah. I think that's a good start to what probably ended up being a pretty active career. So why don't you talk to us about your SEAL career?
Yeah. So as you know, a lot of times we have twisted mentalities. Like, I found myself what I would consider being a very fortunate situation that most people would probably think is the opposite, in that every deployment that I went on for the 10 years that I was in was a active deployment, meaning we were doing real world operations, which is very, very rare. Even in a wartime environment, SEALs cover the whole world. So it's usually very, only one or two groups get to do anything. And right. I was lucky in that from my very first deployment, even pre-9/11, was to do interdiction ops for Saddam smuggling oil out of Iraq, and ended up in that, creating a new method of breaching vessels that eventually got taught to the whole SEAL community. I got written up, like, just as a junior O, like, I was supposed to, like, not cause trouble, but ended up being on the pointy end of the spear of building out new tactics for assaulting vessels. I got back from that deployment, and 3 days later, September 11th happened. And so I remember waking up that morning to a phone call and coming to the team. We were on call, ended up not getting deployed to Afghanistan. Another platoon took off for Afghanistan. We went to, in the training, my next plan was to Southeast Asia. We did some work in the Philippines and then got consolidated in Kuwait for Operation Iraqi Freedom. Team 3 was responsible for all the combat operations until major combat operations were done. Right. So that was just over a year. We did the largest special operations mission in history, securing Iraq's oil infrastructure right before the war kicked off, as in, like, we had to complete this mission prior to any other hostilities. It was a humongous mission. My particular role in that was to lead the force that secured the world's largest oil platform that was rigged with explosives. So, like, just in layman's terms, my job was to go have a gunfight on the world's largest gas station that's rigged with bombs. So that was a interesting day. Then after I got back from that deployment, I suffered an injury on that deployment, got assigned to a unit to do non-traditional SEAL operations. So not really to build the capability. So I was in charge of a 3-man element. I was 2 senior chiefs and a warrant officer and me. And our job was to build out the SEAL's capability to do intelligence, surveillance, technical surveillance, dogs. The dog program fell under us, UAV program, like all of the things that were non-traditional stuff. Started building that out and then got deployed to Lebanon for a year, working with an Army SF warrant. We were the only 2 US military operating in the country doing intelligence type operations. It was right after Prime Minister Hariri was assassinated. That's when I was sent over there. Syrians were still there. Like, it was a very, very dangerous time. So I did that for a year. Again, some more injuries, and eventually had a career-ending surgery. Had operated for almost 2 years with more or less a broken back. And when the surgeon went to fix it, he nicked my L4, L5 nerve root. And I lost all feeling in my right leg, or 3/4 of the feeling down that pathway. So that was the end of my SEAL career. Got medically retired in 2008.
Brutal. A couple of things I want to hit. One is, if I was a 17-year-old and Top Gun 2 came out, I would be right where you were. So I don't think the Army does quite as good a job mixing with Hollywood.
Base selection or movies.
The marketing machine between
Black Hawk Down is your best one, and
that's true.
Shit show. I don't think we want to join up.
Yeah, it's the opposite of a recruiting. Unbelievable. Second thing is, Army Special Forces specializes in really capacity building in other militaries. Navy SEAL, do you have a similar portion of your mission around education?
I'd say only when there's nothing else for us to do. I know, like, our primary mission is direct. Like, if you were to specialize or say, what is the specialty of all these different units? Like, you've got, like you said, SF is all about building and supporting internal forces, right? Counterinsurgency, really, or like these forces to fight on your behalf and with you. Marines are to assault enemy held beachheads, right? Like, it's their primary mission.
Yep.
SEAL's primary mission are direct action missions, anything in or around the water, and or where it's expanded is very, let's call it, technical or high risk direct action missions. So since 80% of the world's population lives within 100 miles of the water, like, it's not that big of a stretch to say that the SEALs are the unit of choice for any specialized high risk mission in and around the coast.
Got it.
Now, we'll do some of that, but we call it FID, Foreign Internal Defense. And it's like, the worst thing we ever have to do. And none of us ever want to do it. And they only make us do it when we got nothing else to do.
Got it. I was curious about that because I want to get into the transition from your military career into what the body of work has been since 08. And it seemed to be very, at least parts and pieces of it are very curriculum and education driven. So
100%.
Let's talk about one, your transition. You have a medical career ending issue. So I'm sure you had some chance to reflect and navigate.
It's a horrible story, which we won't go into now. But yeah, the Navy and the Naval medical system really screwed me over pretty bad. Like it was a bad couple of years. But I was laying in Bethesda. The surgeon came in. So after supposedly fixing my back, and I woke up and it felt like there's boiling oil being poured down my back and leg. And I asked what happened. He said, oh, there's so much damage to that area. There's so much scar tissue. When I was cleaning up, I nicked the nerve root, and that's your nerve dying. And it's like, eventually that pain will go away, but then you'll have no feeling and you may lose some use. Like, we don't know how much use you're going to have at the end of this. And then he's like, your SEAL career is over. And then he left. Like, that was it. And
good bedside manner.
Oh yeah. Awesome. Sitting there my whole life, ever since I was third grade, was this. Like, I had zero plans past the SEALs. I didn't really expect to live past 30, much less have a career past the SEAL community. I didn't plan on being a lifer, but I expect, like, I was heading towards Damneck to SEAL Team 6 or whatever, development group, whatever you want to call it. Like, that was my whole goal of being a SEAL. And I figured I had probably another 4 or 5 years of operating with them before I'd have to choose if I wanted to stick it out, or I most likely would have gotten out at that point. So I had no backup plans. And really, it was this, my whole life at this point was focused on, I'd say, fighting for freedom, right? Freedom. It sounds corny, but like, freedom of the SEAL standing next to me. I truly believe that our way of life as an American is something that we owe. Like, the freedom I get to enjoy, I owe something for. And so to me, service was that. And also being able to bring more freedom to the world through liberating people that are oppressed from what I would consider our bullies, right? And being a little kid that got bullied a lot, what better way to make up for that than be a SEAL, you know, shooting bullies in the face? So that was my whole life. And yet, in that effort of fighting for freedom, as you know from being in the military, like, you're not free. Like, I didn't have any freedom at all.
Yeah.
And so that's really, it was like, well, that's what, maybe it's my turn to experience some freedom. And that's what led me to entrepreneurship. Not because I had any desire to build a company or be a CEO or get recognition. It was just a strategy for freedom of choice, freedom of revenue, and the ability to create something of value. And so I started to go into entrepreneurship in that, you know, on that hospital bed.
It's interesting because I agree with you. You articulated a lot better, but when I was getting off active duty, I felt like the needs of the Army had dictated everything that I had done up until that point. And it was overwhelming, like trying to make a decision of what to do. Like, oh my God, I have all of these options. How the hell do you choose one? And I think in my case, the small business or more entrepreneurial business path was the place to at least allow yourself to explore and enjoy that freedom, as opposed to, you know, and this is not against corporate America, but it was in my head, a corporation is just like the Army, where I'm going to be a bit of a slave to their decisions. How do you create freedom? So
I don't know about you, but to me, that was one of the most cruel tricks of my life, right? So I start entrepreneurship. I'm like, I'm going to be free. Bullshit, right? Like, the least free I've ever been is the CEO of a small business that I'm building from scratch.
Yeah. There was a video recently, I think it's the CEO and founder of NVIDIA, who basically said, if you ask an entrepreneur to sign up for entrepreneurship after the fact, nobody would do it because it's that hard. So we're going to continue romanticizing the dream of entrepreneurship because America relies on it. It can be anything but romantic.
Well, and that's where the quote that's on your wall that you we talked about, right? Like, our definition of success is usually set a goal or objective and achieve it, right? And the more that we set these goals and objectives and achieve it, the more successful we are. And it, as an entrepreneur, you have that ability to set your own goals, and then your own effort helps you achieve it. And you think, if I do that a lot, right? If I do that on a big, big base, big level, like, I'll be successful. But ultimately, that's the trap we get into with entrepreneurship, right? Accomplishments do not equal success. Like, you know, sale, bottom line, none of that equals success. If you have a miserable experience every day in producing those accomplishments, how can you call that a successful life? That was a big turning point for me, is understanding that I've got this definition wrong.
So let's go there, because, I mean, I'll try to do the highlights. You correct me. You went into some curriculum development around teaching character to...
But started, so yeah, it actually started with my expertise, which was surveillance, technical surveillance, human intelligence. So I spent so much time doing that. I built a consulting company that did that, where I designed products and then trained people how to use them, units. Ultimately getting into, of all things, I got hired by Disney Studios to solve their movie piracy issues. And so I did that. Problem with that was we were too effective. We caught every pirate, everyone that was camcording movies in North America, well, in US, Canada, and Mexico in 9 months. And so I just literally worked myself out of a job. And it was
that's actually what good consulting should be.
Oh yeah. $3 billion problem that ultimately I probably made $250,000. Like, if I could have told them I'm going to solve your $3 billion problem in less than a year, they would have paid me
$100 million. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll give you $100 million. I made like 200 grand. So it was like bad business model. So did that, got into actually personal safety and self-defense from the perspective of, this is where you're going to start seeing the theme, not skills, but behavior, right? So most companies in this space were focused on skills. Like, if I teach you how to shoot or punch, you'll be safe. But in reality, what kept me safe in Lebanon by myself was not, if I shot around there, I was done. It's situation awareness, behavior change, right? How do I identify threats and avoid them? So we built a company based on that, that also taught skills. So we built a custom training facility in Minneapolis. We would train anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 people a year. And our focus was on the non-enthusiast. Like, if you are terrified of guns or to throw a punch, those are the people we helped, which is what led into curriculum design. So school systems took notice of our ability to influence behavior change and asked me to assess their anti-bullying programs, because they were having issues with bullying. And what I identified is that they didn't have a bullying issue. They had a lack of leadership development. And anywhere you have leadership, you don't have bullying. And everywhere you have bullying, you don't have leadership. Leadership is using your power to help people. Bullying is using your power to hurt people. So they are literally polar opposites. Hmm. And so that's where I started. They challenged me with creating leadership development curriculum for middle schoolers, fifth, sixth, seventh graders, that a teacher would deliver, but the teachers union wouldn't allow us to train the teachers. So there's no training of the teachers, just build curriculum that a teacher could teach respect to a fifth grader the morning of the lesson. And so that was really the start of curriculum design, or at least in the leadership space. Built that curriculum, and I started getting requests from parents because there's some homework. And so, like, the fifth grader bring home their lesson in communication, talk to their parents about what it means to communicate and how to effectively communicate. And I started getting calls from parents saying, hey, I just saw my fifth grader's lesson on communication. Can you come teach my executive team how to communicate? And so that's what led into consulting.
Got it. And then when did you write the book? And for everybody that's listening, How Leadership Actually Works, A Navy SEAL's Complete System for Coordinating Teams, which I want to get into. The two major themes I pulled out of Larry's presentation and the book were, everything about leadership is about coordinating action through teams, and that success is not defined by external validation or by goal accomplishments, but it's actually And as he said, it's on my whiteboard. Success equals an optimized daily experience sustained over time, which were two of the most game-changing nuggets. And I think I've been around leadership for a while, but they were really poignant points that kind of paradigm shifting, I would say. So
that's my expertise is paradigm shifts. Like it's my crack. I love watching that. I love doing that to people because there's this weird reaction. It's a physiological reaction to when you shift someone's paradigm. And what it means to shift a paradigm is what they've held to be true up to this point shifts to a new truth. And when you do that, you literally change someone's world, right? Everything they see through a different filter. Everything they choose to do, they do through a different filter. And I love watching it. Whenever it happens, someone will like do this like jerk and then they look up and to the left because they're like resetting the nervous system. And those paradigm shifts, I would say there's three big ones, right? That first one, that foundational one is the redefining of success. And where it really hits is say I accomplish every goal I've ever set, but in the production of that accomplishment, my life is miserable. I have led a life of misery. That can't be success, right? And so by shifting our focus and saying that when I focus on fulfillment, when I focus on optimizing my daily experience and especially making it sustainable over time, accomplishments will follow. So we're really just shifting our focus.
Right.
Right. There's no way to feel fulfilled if those you love are suffering. Therefore, you had to have produced accomplishments to experience that fulfillment. But when I focus on accomplishments at the cost of my feelings of fulfillment, I'd never get it. Right. So I can get accomplishments, but be miserable. If I produce a world where my world is optimized and I feel fulfilled on a daily basis, I've not only get the feeling of fulfillment, I get that amazing experience today and over time, but accomplishments will follow. Like that's the first big piece that I think would show up in that conversation.
Inspiring People in Places is brought to you by MCFA. MCFA is a CVE verified service disabled veteran owned small business. At MCFA, our why is to inspire people in places through project leadership. We provide planning, strategy, program management, and construction management support services to a wide variety of public and private sector clients. I agree. And I'd be curious because the way you articulate it is what I grabbed at because it was like the word fulfillment sounds way too loose. But when you convert and bring together, you're not ignoring the fact that accomplishments matter in this world and that affecting impact matters.
It's a requirement for fulfillment. But if I focus on the accomplishment, I give up the feeling of fulfillment. This is why, right? There's a principle behind this. Fulfillment can only come from acting towards an internally derived, deeply held purpose.
You got to say that again. You got to say, everybody's about to take out their notepad. Say it again.
Yeah, I speak in very dense things. Fulfillment can only be experienced by living towards a deeply held, internally derived purpose. Now, the reason that I give up fulfillment by going after accomplishments is that those accomplishments always come from outside of me. A goal or objective is always outside of me. And so when that goal or objective is externally derived, I can't feel fulfilled even in its accomplishment.
Makes sense.
The purpose is the key. And then, well, what's purpose? Purpose isn't a fuzzy concept. Purpose is that which drives a specific end, right? So whatever drives me towards some specific end state is what is my purpose. Okay, what is the end state that I want to drive after? It has to be an emotional state that produces a certain set of behaviors in the future. So unless I know what I want to feel in the future and what I want to avoid feeling, I can't identify the purpose for my actions. If I can't identify the purpose for my actions, even in producing accomplishments, I can't feel fulfilled. If I can't feel fulfilled, I can't experience success, even though I produced accomplishments.
All right, everybody. You can either listen to it again or you can get the book. I listened to the book. I have the hard copy here because I want to read it and highlight it. All right, let's talk about leadership and what leadership management and coordinating action have to do with each
other.
That's
the other huge paradigm shift. Like, we've already kind of, we're starting the headache starting for most people. Like, it's going to get worse right now. So just let them know. We're going to twist up your minds on this one. Your fundamental understanding of the distinction between leadership and management ensures that you will not be able to lead or manage well, right?
You're going to say that again. Just so everybody understands, I just listened to this stuff in the last 90 days. Maybe I got exposed to it right before Christmas. That's how available Larry was to me. Within 3 weeks, I got him on the podcast after I got introduced to him.
Because of Jimmy.
Jimmy, So shout out to Jimmy Reeland. But I have been talking leadership versus management for a very, very long time. Yeah. And I want Larry to say it again, because we all have it a little backwards.
And you've been talking about it for a very long time, and I guarantee it's backwards. Mm-hmm. Like, the fundamental understanding of leadership and management is backwards for people. And what I mean by that, by backwards, is it is the understanding that you have will limit your performance significantly. And the highest functioning teams work within the concepts of leadership and management in a completely different way than everyone else, hence their performance. And this came from my experience in the SEALs. As a lieutenant in a platoon, I'm the most senior person in that platoon. By having that positional authority, that creates a specific role for me. And most people would say that my job is to lead the platoon. But the reality is that that's backwards. My job is to manage the platoon. And my job is to create an environment for leadership among every member of my platoon. Ultimately, because as a lieutenant, I have not the least experience, but I mean, nowhere near even the middle, right? My average SEAL has 2-3 years more experience. My senior enlisted SEALs have decades more experience than I do. And so if I go in with this concept that my job is to lead these men, which is directly evoking their action, right? If my job is to directly evoke their action, I'm probably the worst one to do that, right? My chief, who's been doing this for 20 years, he should directly be evoking action in me. He knows what the hell's going on. So if leadership is directly evoking action, what is management? The primary role of a manager, and what is a manager, is anyone with positional authority. So by the nature of being lieutenant, I have positional authority. I can use force from my position to make people do stuff. As soon as I have positional authority, my job is to manage. And my primary role as a manager is to create, enable, and support leadership. And again, the key words here, create, enable, and support leadership, not lead. A person with positional authority that leads, meaning if I had to directly evoke action in my SEALs, that is one of the least effective things I can do. If I create a space where every one of my SEALs can directly evoke action in each other and in me towards our desired end state, I've produced almost infinite capability.
Yeah.
And so the big distinction between leading and managing is, am I directly evoking action in someone else that I'm leading? Or am I creating the opportunity and the space for people to directly evoke effective action in each other? Then I'm managing.
And you can be both a leader and a manager, right?
Yes and no, right? Yes, you can, right? And there's three roles, because then you have followers, right? So followers are ones that are taking action. And this is what's interesting when you make that distinction between a follower that is taking action, a leader is directly evoking action in followers or someone who is following, and a manager's job is to create, enable, and support leadership and effective followership in their organization. Many managers, people with positional authority, actually follow a lot, right? Where they're directly doing. And the impact you can have in the overall, let's call it mission, decreases as you go down, right? So if I am in action, that's the least impact I can have. If I'm directly evoking action in others, I get more impact. If I'm creating a space where everyone can evoke action and take action effectively, I'm having the most impact. So every moment that I spend as a follower in my management position, I'm decreasing the overall impact of the organization. Every minute I spend leading in my organization, I'm directly reducing the impact that the organization can have. So think about it from the military perspective. General Patton, right? One of the best military leaders in the world. No, it's one of the best military managers. How many tanks did he drive?
Right.
Zero. How many times did he tell these tanks to go there and those tanks to go there? Hardly ever, right? Never. His job was to create a space so that all of his tank commanders and ultimately everyone in the organization knew where to go, when to go, and how to do it. So his job was to create a space for leadership and followership, not to lead or follow. So you can spend time leading, but as soon as you are, you're reducing the potential impact you can have towards the desired end state.
I don't want to go all the way into unpacking this, but I believe that Stephen Covey was probably the first person that talked in my world through books or presentation about the difference between leadership and management. And he was really focused on kind of the vision and soft skills of a leader versus the resource.
That's the most common thing, right?
The resource optimizer.
Visionary person at the top, and managers are a necessary evil to implement a leader's vision.
Right.
And that is, I think, the biggest misconception in how it works. Like, look at the best military units, right? The best military units, the manager, right? The most senior person isn't a leader, like isn't on the battlefield. Follow me. Like, that doesn't work. It works, but it's not as effective as creating an entire world of leaders, which is my job. So my job as a lieutenant in the platoon was to establish a space where every single one of my SEALs knew how to lead, knew they were expected to lead, and had the understanding that each other one could step into leadership at any moment, right? Because if we're in a firefight and all of a sudden you see a more effective place to go, I need to immediately follow you. And our ability to switch, our team's ability to switch between leading and following was almost instantaneous. And in their ability to switch between leading and following quickly, enables us to respond quicker than our enemies. And my job is to stay in the back and make sure that it's happening, not to actually lead or follow.
So the best managers are actually empowering leadership to the lowest level and then creating in the environment that enables leaders and followers to switch places when necessary.
What's the difference between a leader and a follower?
One's evoking action, one's taking action.
That's it. Time and situation.
Right.
There is no difference. But what most organizations, if you were to ask, you know, who are leaders here? A third of the room raised their hand. The other two thirds won't, because they're followers. But they aren't. We all lead. And where did we learn to lead? As babies. Best leaders in the world are babies. You know, they get you to do whatever the hell they want nonstop.
There's a line in your book. Let me see if I can grab it really quick. I think I had it marked. We are all born leaders, then life teaches us how to be bad at it.
Yeah.
That's a good line.
I like that one.
All right. Now that we screwed everybody up, talk about leadership and management and how it relates to
coordination of action.
Well, I was actually going to say commander's intent, desired end state, and coordination of action. Those three things.
I've been saying, like, in the distinctions that I shared, a leader's job is to directly evoke action towards a desired end state. A manager's job is to create, enable, and support leadership. A follower's role is to take action towards the desired end state. What is a desired end state? As a SEAL, our battlefield environments were so dynamic that if we were tasked with specific missions, like go take this house, by the time we got to the house, the battlefield's changed so much that even in successful execution of that mission, we didn't accomplish the goal of the objective because the terrorists moved to the house next door. So our commanders wouldn't tell us what to do. They would tell us their intent. And what that looked like is, this is what the battlefield looks like when you're done, right? This is what it looks like in the future. They'd leave it up to us to identify the specific mission, the strategy to produce it. That enabled us to adjust on the fly and continue to create and bring their intent into life, even if the particular strategy we chose in the moment was no longer effective. I adopted that same philosophy for business, because where so many people get frustrated in organizations is in strategic changes or tactical changes, like go do this. And then they do it. And when they come back, the manager's like, okay, yeah, I need you to do this instead now. They're like, well, you just told me to do that. Why do I have to do this now? Right. Anytime that we lead in tactics, which are very specific, they change all the time, create all sorts of frustration. If we lead in strategies, they change a little less in tactics, but they're still situationally dependent. When we're able to identify the purpose or the reason why we're doing it, that reason why doesn't go anywhere. So another place you would have seen this is Simon Sinek's.
I was just going to say, start with why. Yeah.
Yeah. His speech, where the why is in the center, the what is next, and the how is last. And most people go the wrong direction. Like, how are we going to get this done? What are we doing? Why are we doing it? They have no clue. This is the same philosophy, right? Why we do something is the desired end state. And what we found, the most effective desired end states are ones that come from describing emotional states. Because ultimately, humans are driven by producing certain emotional states and avoiding other emotional states.
Right.
That becomes the why we do something. And the emotional states we want to produce don't change very often. Strategies are what we're doing. So those are the big steps to produce the desired end state. And the tactics are how we're executing on each part of the strategy. So how we do stuff is the specific tactics, the specific actions. How are domains of followers, right? The people that are directly taking action are the owners of the tactics of the how. Leaders are the owner of strategy, what we do. That's where they're directing the actions of the followers or the tactics of the followers. And desired end states are the domain of managers, right? So the manager's job is to be able to clearly define why we are doing this and what it looks like when we're successful. And being able to communicate that to their leaders enables them to then pick the right strategies and allows the tacticians of the followers to execute on those strategies.
All right, everybody. We should probably just stop there, and you can keep rewinding and re-listening. But we're going to move to some rapid fire questions. Yeah. Larry says he's not as good at this, but no. We'll see. All right. Outside of your book, most recommended book or most gifted book?
I'd say the most recommended. I love Getting Things Done by David Allen. Like whenever I get stuck and not moving the fast as I want, that's where I go right back to that book. So I'd say that's probably the most common one. Funny Another enough. One that I really like is Iron War, which is about triathletes, but it talks about self-regulation. And ultimately, I believe that our ability to self-regulate mentally, emotionally, and physically is the greatest determiner of our potential for success in our life. So that's, I'd say the second one.
Awesome. Favorite quote?
Oh, shit, none. I have no quotes. Reason being is I've a couple things. So one, I don't do well with memorizing anything, especially specific words. And second, I've got a TBI that damaged my corpus callosum. So I can no longer hear lyrics. A good example is lyrics. So like if I'm listening to a song, if I hear the words, I can't follow the story. If I follow a story, I lose the words. And so quotes are very much the same thing for me of if I think about the intent, I can't grab the words. If I think of the words, I can't follow the intent. So sorry, wow. No quote.
But you gave us enough quotables because, I mean, you can recall everything that you've written. And just so everybody knows, prior to getting on the call, we were talking about the curriculum building. And he said he basically trying to narrow down how to teach a fifth grader respect and make it a simple definition. He spent 80 hours just trying to simplify the definition of respect into 7 or 8 words. I won't ask you to recall it, but
I can if you like.
Let's do it.
Okay. So respect is understanding how something impacts your world and choosing to act in accordance with it.
Say that again.
Understanding how something impacts your world and choosing to act in accordance with it.
All right. That's quotable.
Yeah.
There you go.
The crazy part, like why I bring that up is if you look up, try to look up respect, you get Webster's Dictionary, which uses respect in the definition, or doctorate level philosophy. There is nothing in between for respect. It's one of the hardest ones. Everyone thinks they know what respect is, but until you ask them, well, tell me what it is and don't give me an example, no one can give you an answer.
That's great. All right. If you could have dinner with three people, dead or alive, who would they be?
Okay. I go with Jesus would be one of them for sure. I think Einstein would be an interesting dinner thing. I'd definitely like to have dinner with Elon Musk too. I think our Asperger's would align, be an interesting conversation.
Anything outside of your work that you're heavily involved in or passionate about?
Not really. Like we were talking, we didn't really talk about it now, but I've gotten to really get into one of my biggest passionate projects is I found that the biggest limitation of growth of a structurally sound organization are the unrecognized and unresolved traumas of this senior team. And so I dove deep into mitigating post-traumatic stress in my life and experience, leveraged that with other veterans, and then started identifying these same patterns in entrepreneurs. And so I've been spending a ton of time being able to bring that to a larger audience, being able to identify and resolve traumas that exist in humans' lives that limit their performance.
And so what form is that taking? I mean, mental health therapy is the traditional form. Yeah. How are you scaling that?
I'm scaling it through large group and small group calls. So large group calls where I will teach the fundamentals of these different, well, before you can understand how that works, in distillating or regressing 13,000 linguistic data points that I collected through working with over 120 high functioning individuals, I identified six core patterns of dysfunction that trauma creates in an individual's life. So what we're doing is attacking those six dysfunctional strategies, which is cool because most people think that the traumatic experience is what we have to cure, the emotional charge of it. But in reality, it's the behaviors that come from that experience that cause problems in our life. If we fix those behaviors, the trauma has no power over us, so it doesn't matter. And so what's unique about this process is we don't talk about what happened to you. I don't care what happened to you. What I care about is what did you carry forward from what happened to you that causes dysfunction today? Mm. When we solve that, trauma has no place to live. It has no impact on your life. So it's a process of fixing behavior carried forward from trauma, not a process of mitigating the emotional charge of the traumas. What's cool about that is, at least my experience with post-traumatic stress therapy was they just kept putting me back into the traumas. And that didn't work. Like, if anything, it made it worse. So this process is amazing based on the fact that you don't ever have to talk about the bad things that happen to you. We just fix your behaviors today that you carried forward from those bad things. And so that's done through large group calls and then small group facilitation with facilitators, coaches.
Anything we didn't cover that you want to hit with the audience?
I mean, I'd say I've been so passionate about this trauma stuff. Like, how do you know? Because most of you sitting out there do not identify with having trauma in your life. You know, not everyone goes to war and, you know, or has sexual assault or loses a loved one or gets cancer. But the common thread between all of those experiences is a perceived loss of control. So what drives traumatic experiences in humans is any time that we perceive that we lose control of our environment. That means that every human experiences trauma early in life. And all trauma is the lesson that we carried forward from surviving those experiences. How do you know this exists in your life? If you feel like you're just one new awareness book, coach, podcast away from hitting your next level, but you never seem to quite get there, that's a sign of trauma. That's one of the limiting signs. If you live your life producing all sorts of accomplishments, but no fulfillment, that's a sign that trauma's in your life. And if you choose strategies that create disconnection in your life, either from yourself, others, or let's call it the world, that's a sign that trauma's role in your life. And being open to knowing that that trauma doesn't have to come from some big ass horrible experience. Knowing that, just opening to that, is the first step to getting some freedom from it. Like, that to me would be an important message to share, because the end results of dealing with this stuff is your performance gets unlocked, which ultimately becomes the least important thing. You finally get to feel fulfillment through the accomplishments you produced, and you get to produce and live in the, I'd say, almost infinite love or connection that exists around us at all times, which ultimately becomes the most important thing in the life.
Awesome. Larry Yatch, thanks for all of the work that you've put into both leadership and trauma. And thanks for taking the time with us today.
No, my pleasure.
Hey, everybody. If you're enjoying this show, do us a favor and subscribe to Inspiring People and Places on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast hosting platform. We'd also greatly appreciate if you left us a review and shared this with other entrepreneurial public servants and all your friends and family in the AEC space. Be sure to visit our website, www.mcfaglobal.com. Sign up for our newsletter to stay in touch with us and learn about all of the projects and clients we're helping. Last but not least, we are hiring. We are always hiring. Do us a favor. Take a look at what jobs we have open. Contact us through our website or connect with me on LinkedIn. Until next time, have a great rest of your week and a great weekend.